the Antiwhite system and tune in to the Pro-White system at RadioArian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday, the 30th of May, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And today is part three of our series on lost white civilizations. And today we're going to be looking at the Middle East. Now, so far in this series, I've been using March of the Titans by Arthur Kemp. But I don't think he's particularly accurate where he's talking about the Middle East. He labours under the misapprehension that the Israelites were the same as the modern Jews. Now, I've done podcasts about this before, particularly Aryan Esoterica, who went into some of this, and I've also done podcasts about Jesus not being a Jew. And it is well recorded that the tribe of Judah, the remnant of the tribe of Judah, when it came back from Babylon in the 5th century BC, they had intermingled with some Arabic tribes, mixed race tribes, and they kicked all of them out, and they remained pure for another 200 years. And then about 250 BC, they annexed the countries around them and interbred with them. And the countries around them were called Edomites, and the Edomites were descended from Canaanites. So and it was at that point that the tribe of Judah became a mixed race tribe, and they became what we call today Semites. Prior to that point, somebody who was descended from Shem would have been a white man. Now, we know this because we know that Japhet was white. We are taught by the church. We've always been taught by the church. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japhet. And Japhet was white. He is apparently the ancestor of all the European peoples. Japhet was white. Therefore, if Japhet is white, and he had two brothers, and his two brothers came from the same mother and the same father, then his two brothers were white as well. So that means that Shem was white, that the tribe of Judah came from, and it also means that Ham was white, that the original Egyptians came from. They were all originally white. So obviously something happened to them at a later stage to turn them brown and to turn them Semitic. And the only thing that could have happened to them is interbreeding with non-white races. And of course, we do read about this happening in the Bible, and we hear about it in the historical record. We hear of Cush that became Ethiopia. We hear of Cush interbreeding. We hear of Mizraim, which is Egypt. We hear of them interbreeding. In fact, it was the sons of Ham that were the first to mix themselves up and mingle themselves with the other races. We also hear of where Noah's Ark rested is the Caucasian Mountains. So, of course, when the people came down from the Caucasian Mountains, the first place they ended up was the Fertile Crescent, which again we read about in the Bible, the Tower of Babel and Babylon, this first city that was built. And that was built in the Fertile Crescent, which is where the first civilizations of the world began. That's right there in the Middle East. Now, one of the mistakes that Arthur Kemp makes, he looks at the Fertile Crescent and he says, well, it's not very fertile, it's all a desert area. Well, it is a desert area now, but it wasn't a desert area 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. It's like looking at Judea or the Palestine that they now call Israel. Yes, that is a very desert-like place, but the reason why that is a desert-like place is because the Romans cut down all the trees when they destroyed the pagan temple there, the Jews' pagan temple. The Romans cut down all the trees when they were putting the place to siege and destroying it, executing God's wrath upon the Jews. And ever since then, it's been a desert. But it wasn't a desert before then. I mean, we read about it being lush and all the forests of Lebanon. And we read about it being excellent farming land. So the Fertile Crescent was very, very good farming land. And that's why the first civilizations were there. And once we had civilization, we had the technological skill from having from being settled in one particular area, then the sciences flourished, and we learnt the skills that we needed to move to the harsher parts of the world, such as the north, moving into Europe and moving further east. But the first white civilizations were in the Middle East. The first one was Sumer, and we must all be aware of the statues, the blue-eyed statues in Sumer, and how they talked about how they ruled over dark-skinned people. And we see the technical skill that they had in some of the ornate headdresses that they made. We see the statues. We don't actually have any bodies of them, but we can see the statues, the representations that they made of themselves. And they are all white. We can also see the skill that they had. They had writing. Negroes have never had writing. But they had writing in Sumer, and it's some of the earliest writing that we actually have. Now, I'm going to read to you from Arthur Kemp's book about Hammurabi, because he's quite a famous white king at that time. And this is round about 1763 BC in the Middle East. Hammurabi was the first famous king of Babylon, who managed to end the chaos and unite all the tribes into a nation. He is probably most remembered for his code of law, dating from 1750 BC, which is widely but incorrectly held to be the first written legal code in the world. It was actually the second, the first being the code drawn up by the earlier white Sumerians. Hammurabi's code of law was engraved in stone and set up in the great cities of the region. And to this day, the code is regarded as the father of all legal codes of the world. An original copy of one of his codes is on display in the Louvre Museum in Paris, France. While some of the laws seem harsh to the modern mind, death for being unable to repay debt, for example, the wording of the prologue to the Code of Law provides a fascinating glimpse into the conflict between the mixed race and white populations in the region. In the prologue, Hammurabi announces that he has come to rule the black-headed people. He is also referred to as the White King and the White Potent, apparently in reference to his colouring. The original introduction to the Hammurabi Code states the following: Hammurabi, the exalted prince who feared God, to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evildoers, so that the strong should not harm the weak, so that I should rule over the black-headed people like Shamash, that's the sun god, and enlighten the land to further the well-being of mankind. Hammurabi, the prince, called of Bel, am I, making riches and increase, who enriched Ur, the white king, the mighty, who again laid the foundations of Sippurah, the lord who granted new life to Iraq, who brought plenteous water to its inhabitants, the white potent, who penetrated the secret cave of the bandits. And that's translated by L.W. King from the 11th edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. Although the Code of Law drew a distinct line between Hammurabi himself and the black-headed peoples, it also showed that by this time, large numbers of the population had become mixed race. Nonetheless, building upon the technological and cultural precedents set by the Sumerians, the Babylonians maintained the complex system of canals, dikes, weirs, and reservoirs constructed by the original white inhabitants. As an indicator of the symbolism Babylon has come to acquire, to this day the black Rastafarian movement talks about all white civilizations as being Babylon. Now, there is often an understanding, which is a false understanding, that the Hittites were white. Now, the Hittites were descended from the Canaanites. The Canaanites interbred with the races of the land, and they became Arabs. And the Hittites themselves, the reason why people think the Hittites were white is because that area that they lived in, that huge area, it was taken over by white people for a significant portion of the time that we call them Hittites. Back then, it was the same as today. People were named after the geography that they lived in. They were, you know, if you lived in Canaan, you were called a Canaanite. If you lived in Moab, you were called a Moabite. The same as if you live in Britain today, it doesn't matter what race you are, even though it's wrong, you are called British. You're called a British citizen. And that is a mistake that we've been making for thousands of years. But we have carvings of the Hittites, and we have carvings of them with Jewish noses. That's where the Jews got their nose from, and that confirms the truth of the record that Esau Edom married Canaanite wives. Esau Edom was Jacob Israel's twin brother. We're also told that he had red hair, and he was very hairy. And obviously, Jacob Israel had red hair as well, if his twin brother did. But his twin brother, we are told, married the daughters of Heth. And these Hittites, who are the people of Heth, they have the Jewish nose, and of course the Jews today have the Jewish nose. It's one of the Semitic markers. Also, at that time, we had a group of people called the Phoenicians. Now, some people think the Phoenicians weren't white, but they quite clearly were. And I'll begin quoting from Arthur Kemp's book on the Phoenicians, and then I have another one which we'll use as well to elaborate upon it. A number of other smaller white cultures sprang up in this region, each of them contributing in their own way to the advancement of civilization. Among them were the Phoenicians, who through trade established themselves as a powerful nation in the Mediterranean. The Phoenicians are credited with the creation of the modern alphabet, although this is a slight exaggeration. The Phoenicians took the semi-alphabetic script developed by the Egyptians, adopted it, and used it as a means for their trade. The basic alphabet was picked up by later Greeks and developed into Greek script. From this Greek script, the modern alphabet was developed over a much longer period of time. The Phoenicians can claim to having been one link in the process of the development of the modern alphabet. The Phoenicians became famous as traders, establishing settlements all over the Mediterranean basin, including the Italian peninsula and Spain. In 800 BC, the Phoenicians founded the city of Carthage in present-day Tunis, just opposite the bottom of the Italian peninsula. Carthage came to be populated by a large number of different peoples, but retained its essentially Mediterranean-Nordic mix right up until the time of its wars with Rome. Now, I will point out here that he thinks that because the Phoenicians were under Hebrew kings at an early stage, that they must have been mixed race. And this is one of the mistakes these people make, because the Hebrews weren't mixed race at that time. They were still white. And it was actually later on, by the time that they were having wars with Rome, that they did have mixed race people in there. We find traces of Canaanite religious beliefs at Carthage, lots and lots of infant sacrifices. But because he thinks the Canaanites were Nordic, because in the land of Canaan there were Nordic people there, that was the Hebrews that were there, they were the Nordic ones. So because he thinks that the Canaanites were white, he thinks that it was white right the way up to the time of the wars with Rome. But by that time, there was a lot of mixed race peoples there. Continuing, the most famous Carthaginian military leader, Hannibal, who was the scourge of Rome for many years, was a very clear Nordic subracial type who came from a noble family in Carthage. Although Carthage was eventually destroyed by the Romans, it lasted longer than the Phoenician cities in Lebanon, which were razed in 750 BC by new white invaders, the Assyrians. And again, we know the Assyrians were descended from Asher, who was one of the sons of Shem. So that's how come we know they were white. He agrees that they were white, but obviously doesn't put the link there with Shem. Now, I've got some more information on Phoenicia in another book. And this is by Stephen M. Collins, and he has a more positive view of the Phoenicians. The Greco-Romans were the rivals of the Phoenicians and Carthaginians. Greece and Rome were land powers with armies conquering territories to add to a contiguous empire. Phoenicia and Carthage were maritime empires that linked their widely scattered colonies together with large fleets. The Phoenicians and Carthaginians exploited the commerce and mines in their maritime empire to become quite wealthy. The Phoenicians and Carthaginians were capitalists who developed the ancient equivalent of a global economy. They explored for natural resources throughout the world and traded with nations located on different continents. They developed a monopoly as the only middlemen who could link various customers together. Rome and Greece were autocratic empires primarily concerned with extending and preserving their power over conquered nations. Phoenicia and their Carthaginian offspring protected their empire's secrets from Greece and Rome via powerful war fleets, their possession of Gibraltar, and misinformation campaigns. Their dominance over Gibraltar, the Pillars of Hercules, kept enemies and rivals of Phoenicia and Carthage out of the Atlantic Ocean, hiding colonies, mines, and trading stations in Atlantic regions from Greek and Roman eyes. In possessing the strategic gateway of Gibraltar, the Phoenician Empire and Carthage after them enjoyed one of the specific promises of the Abrahamic covenant for the Israelites that Abraham's seed would possess the gate of his enemies. Phoenicia and Carthage kept Greek and Roman ships out of the Atlantic Ocean for centuries, ensuring that the Greco-Roman powers would stay largely ignorant of Phoenicia and Carthage's Atlantic empires. A Roman historian, Strabo, recorded what lengths Phoenicia and Carthage would go to preserve the secrecy of their Atlantic destinations from other nations. Aylett Sams was a British writer from Christ College in Cambridge. His 1676 book, Antiquities of Ancient Britain, cites Strabo's account. Quote, "The Phoenicians very studiously concealed this treasure, the location of their colonies, from them, the Greeks, as we find they did from the Romans, because they, being the great trading nation of the world, they were jealous lest they should lose the advantages, which had hitherto been a peculiar monopoly unto themselves. That this is true, Strabo witnesseth. At the beginning, the Phoenicians alone traded to Britain from Cadiz, and concealed from all others this navigation. But when a Roman vessel followed a certain master of a ship, that they themselves might learn this traffic of merchandise, he ran his ship on purpose upon the sands, and out of the common treasury received the worth of the commodities and wares that he had lost." The account of Strabo details an event where a Carthaginian trading vessel grounded itself rather than reveal to a Roman ship the whereabouts of Carthage's colonies and trading routes. The fact that the scuttled ship's master received replacement funds from the Carthaginian treasury indicates that it was a state policy to conceal Carthage's oceanic routes and destinations from the Greeks and Romans. The same author, Aylett Sams, also wrote the following caustic comment about the ancient Greeks. Quote, "In the days of Solomon, the Phoenicians were arrived to a great perfection in the art of navigation. They made long voyages and imported many rich commodities, but the Grecians made it their business to fasten all the great actions and inventions of the ancients upon something of their own nation, and being better able to write them perform great matters, they brought down the original of arts and sciences to their own low and pitiful epoch." Close quote. Sams wrote as long ago as 1676 that there was a tendency to ascribe to the Greeks certain inventions, arts, and sciences that were actually invented by earlier cultures. Herodotus, a famous Greek geographer, wrote of a Phoenician fleet which sailed around the continent of Africa, starting in the Red Sea and eventually arriving in Egypt by way of Gibraltar on their return trip. Herodotus declares his disbelief of the Phoenicians' account that as they sailed along Africa's coasts, the sun eventually rose on their right hand instead of at their left hand. Obviously, the Phoenician account was completely accurate, but Herodotus's belief of their account is evidence that the Greeks could not comprehend what the Phoenicians knew to be true about world geography. The Phoenicians and Carthaginians were successful at embargoing the Greeks and Romans from Atlantic destinations for centuries. Thomas Johnston writes, quote, Until 500 BC, no Greek ship had penetrated beyond the Pillars of Hercules. Phoenicia was at that time the only navigating power in the world. Close quote. Keep in mind that the Greek definition of Phoenicia included the Kingdom of Israel from 1000 to 700 BC. So for the first three centuries of the first millennium BC, it was actually an Israelite navy allied to the navies of Tyre and Sidon, which kept the Greeks out of the Atlantic Ocean. In writing about the skills of the ancients and that of the Greco-Romans, the respected Dr. Cyrus Gordon rightly observes, quote, "There were ancient mariners in a remote past who could determine longitude, which modern science could not duplicate until the 18th century AD. Worldwide exploration and interconnections were more highly developed in the Bronze Age than in Europe before the age of Columbus and Magellan. In certain ways, such as in navigation and geography, the Greco-Roman world was inferior to that golden age of old, as Strabo rightly infers." Close quote. It is doubtful that you were taught those facts in any of your school history textbooks. Dr. Cyrus Gordon also acknowledges the dominant Israelite role among the Phoenicians of old. He writes, "Herodotus tells us that the Phoenicians came from the Red Sea. The fleets sent out by Hiram and Solomon undertook long voyages, including regularly scheduled missions that took up to 3 years for the round trip. The quest for metals, stones, special woods, and other valued materials impelled the ancient merchant kings, such as Hiram and Solomon, to launch expeditions to the ends of the earth. The skill and drive were there. Naval architecture, along with celestial and other methods of navigation, had been refined, and exploration and cartography had gone through a long development." Close quote. You know, this reminds me very much of the British people, because the British people are supposed to be the, a nation of sailors. Our maritime skills are known throughout the world, and yet here you have these Phoenicians that they were the first ones to be doing this, and they were going to sea for 3 years at a time, and of course we're told that they were trading with Britain. They were coming to Britain to pick up tin from Cornwall. The evidence offered by Dr. Barry Fell in his books confirms Dr. Gordon's statement that the Phoenicians launched expeditions to the ends of the earth. Dr. Gordon mentions Herodotus's record that the Phoenicians came from the Red Sea. Here is a fuller version of Herodotus's statement cited by Dr. Gordon. Quote, "The Phoenicians lived of old, so they say, about the Red Sea, but they came out of there and settled in that part of Syria that is next to the sea. That piece of Syria, and all as far as Egypt, is called Palestine." Although Herodotus was writing about Phoenicians, who were Persian subjects centuries after the Kingdom of Israel fell, he says that the Phoenicians of old had come out of the Red Sea and migrated to a new homeland in Palestine. Even in the time of Herodotus, the memory remained of real events about the biblical Israelites whom the Greeks called Phoenicians. Obviously, it was the Israelites who came through the Red Sea when God parted the waters in the time of Moses, and who went on to settle in Palestine, making it their home. The account of Herodotus strongly confirms the dominant Israelite role in the Phoenicians of old. Now, Herodotus lived circa the 5th century BC, so the time of Moses and King Solomon would have been ancient history to him. Not only would the Phoenicians wreck their own vessels, rather than betray their secrets to their rivals, the ancient Phoenicians had a deliberate disinformation campaign to scare their Greek and Roman rivals off the oceans. Sharon Turner's epic 1805 work, The History of the Anglo-Saxons, includes this commentary on the confusion of ancient people about the location of the ancient Cassiterides, or Cassiterides it says here, Phoenicia's tin mining region in British Cornwall and the Scilly Isles. Turner writes, quote, "Much of the false description with which the position of the Cassiterides has been confused may have been designedly circulated by the Phoenicians themselves, We know from Strabo that they were anxious to deprive the rest of the world of any acquaintance with these islands. Close quote. Many listeners have no doubt seen ancient maps that include drawings of monstrous sea creatures inhabiting the oceans. We already know that the Phoenicians and Carthaginians had state policies of keeping their transoceanic colonies and mines secret from their rivals. What better way to retain their monopoly on transoceanic trade routes than to leak inaccurate maps to their rivals and scare them off the high seas with lurid tales of sea monsters waiting to consume sailors and ships? These actions would obviously serve Phoenician Carthaginian national policy by duping their rivals into believing great dangers lurked on the oceans. Since A, the ancient maps depicting scary sea creatures in the oceans have come to us through the Greco-Roman tradition, and B, neither the Greeks nor the Romans had much of an ocean-going reputation, it is likely that an ancient disinformation campaign of the Phoenicians and Carthaginians was successful beyond their wildest dreams. Not only did they deceive the Greeks and Romans about what was out there on the oceans, but they are still deceiving modern mankind as well. Modern man has been deceived into thinking all ancient cultures feared the sea because modern history texts have preserved Greco-Roman superstitions about the oceans. The ancient Greco-Roman maps are knowledgeable about Mediterranean regions, but are often wildly inaccurate about regions beyond the Mediterranean. This inaccuracy is a testimony to Greco-Roman ignorance about the regions outside the Mediterranean Sea. Their maps likely were their best effort to piece together what limited knowledge of the outside world they had obtained from Phoenician and Carthaginian sources. The Phoenician and Carthaginian sea charts and maps would have been far more accurate, but those precious maps were never shared with Greeks or Romans. Even after Carthage fell to Rome, in 146 BC, Rome remained mostly a land power. They did build large grain ships, which crossed the Mediterranean Sea from Africa to Rome and other cities, but Rome exhibited little interest in transoceanic exploration. A century after Carthage's fall, when Julius Caesar invaded Britain, Sharon Turner wrote about Rome's ignorance of what lay beyond Europe. Quote, "When Caesar invaded Britain, we know from his commentaries that he was unacquainted with its magnitude, its harbours, or its people. The ignorance of other nations, and the designed misinformation given by the Phoenicians, may have occasioned the Cassiterides to become imperfectly known to the Romans." The above digression about the great difference in the nautical skills of the Phoenician Carthaginians and the Greco-Romans was necessary to assist the listener in grasping that transoceanic navigation was common during the Phoenician Golden Age. Modern mankind has assumed that because the Greco-Roman writers were unfamiliar with oceanic travel and world geography, that all ancient civilizations shared that ignorance. This is not true. If Phoenicia and Carthage had emerged the ultimate winners instead of Greece and Rome, modern schools would all teach the truth that international maritime travel and commerce was commonplace in the time of King Solomon, and they would marvel at the backwardness of the Greco-Romans in matters of maritime navigation and related sciences. However, the victors always write the history books, so Greco-Roman ignorance has been exalted as the standard of knowledge in ancient times, and the far more advanced Phoenicians and Carthaginians have been called barbarians. Well, now you know the truth about that. And we've got one more country that we'll look at in the Middle East before we finish, and that's Persia. And now we'll move back to March of the Titans. The leaders of Persia called themselves Arians. Darius the Great, king of Persia, 521 to 486 BC, in an inscription in Naqsh-e-Rostam, near present-day Shiraz, Iran, proclaims, "I am Darius the Great King, a Persian, son of a Persian, an Arian, having Arian lineage." And the Persians actually came from Elam, again, which is another of the sons of Shem. So, of course, he was white. The Iranian plateau was settled about 1500 BC by white tribes, the most important of which were the Medes, who occupied the northwestern portion, and the Persians. The Persians were dominated by the Medes until the accession to the throne by the Persian Cyrus the Great. Well, that may actually be Chris the Great, since the letter C would have been pronounced more like a K, and the Y would have been like a so that could actually be Chris the Great, like the word Christopher today. He overthrew the Median rulers, conquered two neighbouring kingdoms, including Babylonia in 539 BC, and established the Persian Empire as the preeminent power of the Middle East. Cyrus tried to be a benevolent ruler. In Sumeria, he allowed the dominant religion of the time to approve his assumption of the Babylonian kingship, whilst in Jerusalem, he launched the rebuilding of the Hebrew temple. The result of his endeavours was an empire of diverse peoples, which ultimately led to Persia's undoing. Cyrus's son, Cambyses II, extended the Persian realm even further by conquering the by-then thoroughly mixed-race Egyptians in 525 BC. Darius I, who ascended the throne in 521 BC, pushed the Persian borders as far eastwards as the Indus River, had a canal constructed from the Nile to the Red Sea, and reorganized the entire empire, earning the title Darius the Great. From 499 to 493 BC, Darius the Great engaged in crushing a revolt of the Ionian Greeks living under Persian rule in Asia, and then launched a punitive campaign against the Greeks for supporting the rebels. His forces were disastrously defeated by the Greeks at the historic Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. His successor, Xerxes I, also tried to defeat the Greeks, but was in turn defeated in the great sea engagement, the Battle of Salamis, in 480 BC, and in two successive land battles the following year. The forays of the Persian king Xerxes I were the last notable attempt at expansion of the Persian Empire. By this time, the Aryan tribes had started to absorb non-white immigrants and had started to unravel as a homogeneous nation. At the time when the Greek writer Xenophon praised what he called tall, beautiful Persian women during the 6th century BC, the Persian envoys in India were depicted in still existing paintings in the Ajanta caves outside Bombay as light-skinned, blue-eyed and blonde, or dark-skinned and blue-eyed with fair beards. This was the first tangible sign that the Indo-European Persians had started mixing with the darker natives of their land. By the 4th century, this process had spread so dramatically that only a very few of the ruling class could still claim pure white ancestry. Finally, the already largely mixed-race Persians were overrun by the new white force in the region, the White Macedonians, under Alexander the Great, in a series of battles between 334 and 331 BC. The fall of the Persian Empire marked the end of the great majority white civilizations in the Middle East. By this time, all of the settlements had lost whatever racial homogeneity they once had, and were to larger or smaller degrees societies comprised of a plethora of mixed races. They were multicultural, in other words. They produced the wide and varied physiognomy visible to this day in the region, a mix of black, yellow, and white stock that we now call Semitic. From the time of the fall of the Persian Empire, the Middle East ceased to be an area which was majority occupied by peoples who could claim to be white in the original racial sense of the world. Nonetheless, to this day, there remain significant Indo-European genetic throwbacks among the Persians, today called the Iranians. These can also be found among present-day Indians, Afghanis, Iraqis, Syrians, Lebanese, and Palestinians. Persia was eventually overrun by the Arabs in 651 AD, and through the integration which followed, the last major traces of the pure white peoples in the Middle East were diluted. Indeed, much of what later became known as Muslim culture, architecture, writing, and other skills was taken from the Persians into the Arab-speaking world. And they also took a lot of the Christian and Greek knowledge as well when they took over the Greek countries. Constantinople and the other Christian centres. Anyway, that brings us to the end of learning about white people in the Middle East for today. Tomorrow we are going to be looking at Egypt. Thank you for listening. God bless and hail victory. We'll be right back.